Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
What's your favorite community?
A-10. Coolest aircraft I got. It's the Warthog. I think it's the best.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Kodiak Shack podcast. Today, I have Julian Capps, and for all you old school Kodiak Shack listeners, you know that he was our very first guest on the Kodiak Shack podcast. So I appreciate Julian being back. He's at Crowdbotics. We're going to talk about Crowdbotics. We're also going to talk about some of the events that he's been able to go to, because luckily, Julian has his ear to the ground. So what's coming out, new, ITSIC, all those types of AFA conferences. He's able to kind of hear from military leadership, but then also, obviously, he works in the innovation companies. So he has a really good perspective, and I appreciate it. So, Julian, thanks for being back. For all those who didn't hear the first episode, go ahead and tell us about yourself.
Yeah, thanks for having me. My name is Julian. I am in industry, so sort of the enemy, depending on how you look at it. I work for Crowdbotics, crowdbotics.com, and we are kind of relatively new. We've been doing defense for coming up on 4 years now. So we're not historically like a large or even medium-sized defense contractor with millions and millions of dollars in contracts. We are historically a software company from Silicon Valley, so from the Bay Area. We're kind of a standard startup. Our cup of tea, or our kind of, I guess, like, strength is data science so far in the Air Force. All of our defense contracts are with USAF. And basically, we have kind of carved out a data science, data analytics kind of niche, and we're going to run with that. I think that's kind of our biggest offering. We do, on the commercial side, a bunch of different stuff for a bunch of different size companies. So we don't really have kind of like a core offering. We do a bunch of different things in the software realm for a bunch of different, like I said, a bunch of different size companies. But for USAF, data science is kind of our cup of tea. We're looking to, in 2023 and beyond, to switch that up, to kind of expand out. I think there's more that we can do, and I think there's more that the DoD needs from Silicon Valley. We'll get into that. But for now, data science is kind of our cup of tea.
We here at the Kodiak Shack podcast would like to welcome our new sponsor, Adamas Cyber. Working with the military means there are some minimum cybersecurity requirements that are in every contract. Complying with these requirements can be painfully slow and really take your company's focus off your military customers and end users. Thankfully, the team at Adamas has simplified the process exclusively for small businesses working with the military. It should be expected that security requirements are going to be a part of working with the military, but they don't have to be difficult. Learn why prior guests on the podcast, like Arun from Ops Lab or Brian from ResCon, use Adamas to comply with the NIST 800-171, DFARS 7012, and CMMC cybersecurity requirements in their contracts. Check out their website at www.adamascyber.com and tell them you heard about them from the Kodiak Shack podcast. Their website will be in the show notes. We appreciate all the companies that want to work with the military, and we understand working with the government isn't always the easiest thing, but we appreciate companies like Adamas that make it just a little bit easier.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that, as people
who may not know, a lot of companies that are working with the DoD, and it is recommended, they have a commercial side. You know, they're not just a defense innovation company. They have a large commercial side, and then they take that corporate knowledge, and then they expand that to the DoD, because turns out DoD has the same or similar problem sets that corporate America has. So
at least for software. At least for like tech. Definitely. Yeah, big time. Well, and it brings credibility. It. Like the commercial world wants to see, they love like, oh, we do, here's what we do for the government. They're like, oh, sweet. Good enough for Uncle Sam. Good enough for us. And then vice versa. Same thing. Like the DoD loves to see some commercial proof, kind of, you know, social proof there, customer proof.
Well, and I think there's probably a little bit of the kind of the grass is greener feeling where you're talking to people in corporate America and you're like, yeah, we build debrief software for fighter pilots. And they're like, son of a gun. Then you talk to fighter pilots and then you're like, yeah, we actually build a lot of software for like corporate companies. And we're like, dang, that's sick. Like, you know, so each side probably views the other side as like a very interesting group of people. So the,
let me tell you, one of those is right. Yeah. One of those is actually right. Oh, working with the DoD has been painful. I like it. I'm a patriot. I feel like it's a good thing. You end up meeting cool guys like Vader here, but it is a huge pain in the ass on a bunch of other fronts. It's a massive struggle. Totally different from what you're used to in the Silicon Valley world. Timelines, specifically, I would say is kind of the biggest change. But yeah, it is greener if you can stick it out.
Yeah, and I think... So this was a question I was thinking about before we were talking today is, all right, so as you sit here today, think back to when you were wet behind the ears, defense innovation, Julian, and what were your preconceived notions? What were your expectations? Like, oh, when I work with the DoD, it is going to be X, Y, and Z. And then what have you experienced? And what is now your perspective of kind of that defense innovation space?
That's a good question. That's a really good question. First of all, I thought I would be helicoptered everywhere. I thought as soon as we sign this contract, I'm getting picked up in the jet. I'm flying around. I'm Goose. Yeah. I want to be Goose. Yeah. I want to be flown around. I thought I would get to parachute by now. So a lot of disappointment. It's a good question. It's almost just such a massive lack of knowledge of how things get done. And I guess that is a testament to how different the DoD is than the commercial world. Just like the fact that they basically tell you what they need. There are ways to kind of get around that and work directly with people who are brainstorming and thinking, hey, we need to be the tip of the spear in, you know, AI, ML, or whatever. But for the most part, they tell you what they want. The budget is way ahead of time already decided. So there is no like negotiation or pricing and packaging and like toying with that. You know, there's some huge differences. So I would say just like pure ignorance is what I think of when I think back a couple of years, just completely not knowing what it's like. I will say to get more specific, I thought it was much smaller and I guess I knew it was huge, but I just thought that it was maybe less siloed or less stovepiped is probably the way to say it. I didn't realize that there's not kind of like, you know, you hear people say DAF or big Air Force and you think like, okay, there's just like six guys in the Pentagon making decisions. And it's like, there might be, but then there's two hallways over another guy they've never talked to about what they're doing. And he's also spending, you know, $1 billion, $500 million on similar overlapping stuff. So, and then of course you get down to like, it just branches out the more you kind of go down. MAGCOMs stepping on each other's toes or overlapping, and then individual squadrons, we get down to like really kind of frustrating examples. We did a contract with Seymour Johnson, kind of our pride and joy, our kind of like home base, if you will. Our first collaborator was Seymour Johnson, the fourth out there. And they built just kind of, you know, luck of the draw with the IPs that they had. And they have a CAE guy who is... I don't really understand it because it seems more like he works for the Air Force than CAE, but he's out there and he's like real gung ho. And so kind of just luck of the draw with the people that they got, they have really nice, they've got pretty good sleds. They built their own like VR training sleds, and it's not part of the core I think it's not technically part of the training syllabus, but they do as much as they can in the sleds, and they at least show like footage, and they help like student pilots really kind of learn a lot of the kind of ideation instead of using the sticks in the classroom before they go fly. And I've talked to other bases, other squadrons around the United States. Hey, do y'all have the same setup? I just assumed, of course, right? Like everybody's, you know, buying the same shit. No. Sometimes they've never even heard of like the, you know, the setup at Seymour Johnson. They've certainly never seen it. If they have, you know, like an Amazon shopping cart, hey, here's how we set ours up. We took the, you know, the throttle off a Warthog. We took the, you know, yoke off a video game toy. We have the seat from a, you know, video game, whatever. All of that stuff put together to make like a pretty decent sled. That's the only reason they would have found that out is like text message. If they knew one of the IPs from the academy or something like that. And I know this is like your neck of the woods big time. You were in the same position at Holloman trying to throw stuff together, asking people from, you know, your academy days, hey, what are y'all doing at Mountain Home, or what are you doing, you know, wherever the hell. And that unfortunately is like how it gets done. If you want to see like kind of the bleeding edge at the bottom or at the, you know, squadron level, at the kind of, you know, warfighter level, it is thrown together, luck of the draw, lot of overlap, nobody really kind of like talking to each other. And that I never saw coming. So big long-winded answer for you there.
Well, and you had a lot of points there. One thing I got to correct, because the Academy boys will get mad. So I went to Fresno State. I didn't go to the Academy. They'd probably say stolen valor there if I didn't.
Would they be like,
no, I'm just kidding.
Even though you made it to fighter pilot.
Yeah.
It seems like that's the more important achievement. It's like, yeah, I actually,
it probably depends on who you ask, you know? But yeah, what you look at, you know, the Pentagon. And when I was talking to Paco Benitez the first time on the podcast, he said, I think this was on the show. He said that there are more people in the Pentagon today than when they built the Pentagon. And you're like, but before there were computers, before that, you know, when everything that was done was like hand carried places, there are more people, even though we've had force reductions, there's more generals today. So it is, I don't want to say it's a jobs program, but it has become like, we just have a lot more people in the organization, even though the organization is like aggressively smaller, to the point where we have a building that doesn't even fit all the people that are supposed to be in that building. So they have like, you know, satellite buildings for people to work out of. So we have a ton of people. And I say that because the bigger your organization gets, the more difficult it's going to be for everyone to be on the same page. And if you think, you know, and I assume, you know, there are companies, private companies, not even just military or DOD organizations that experience the same thing. You know, you're just going to have that, like the left hand doesn't know what the right hand does, but I think it's aggressively exacerbated between the military, because you have, like you said, the Pentagon, and in the Pentagon, there's, I don't know, tens or hundreds of different organizations that are broken down into subgroups that those people don't know each other. Cause one of the people is from the acquisition side, and you know, they're A5 and there's A3 and, you know, so there's a lot of people who, like you said, maybe working on the exact same thing, spending different money over the same pots of money on the same thing in two different companies. And you're like, man, this may be good or this may be bad. And then we had the, Emily Murphy came on, and just like you said, like you didn't realize the mass of the organization until you kind of got in it. And same thing, I thought like Sibbers and Small Business Innovation, I was like on the leading edge, and turns out they've been doing like SBA, like small business stuff since the 80s. And I was like, oh, well, touche. So yeah, she kind of blew my mind on the fact that there is so much stuff, you know, have been going on over the years.
Not to kiss ass, but I'm glad you brought up that episode. I've literally sent the Emily Murphy episode to like five. It's like a standard thing. I have the link saved on my little notes thing on my laptop now. When we, like if we're hiring or if we're like trying to talk to somebody at another company and trying to kind of bridge the gap, any time that I need to explain a high level here's kind of the lay of the land for us right now. Here's kind of our sweet spot right now. Learn the landscape. I send them the Emily Murphy episode. It's like such a nice little, you know, and if they dig deep, they go, you can find like her papers or stuff that she's written. She's written some stuff I found that where she basically like goes into the same stuff that she talked about on the podcast. But I've sent that episode around now as like a habit when I'm trying to explain. She does a better job, obviously, than I can of kind of talking it through. So as a like selfishly as an industry guy, thanks for having that episode. It's enormously informative. I don't think people like I think people should be forced to sit down and listen to Emily talk for like 5 minutes before they ever start trying a defense contract.
When I
that I've never used defense contract as was, a verb.
Yeah. Start using the and that was kind of my goal. Like my true goal of the podcast was exactly that. I am not the expert. I'm not the expert on, you know, Crowdbotics' data-driven readiness stuff. I'm not the expert on cyber stuff. I want the experts to come here and talk to that. And then my goal is exactly that. I want people to say the best way that you can get a dip a toe or get like a 30,000 foot view of this process, go listen to Emily speak. Because again, she's been doing it for years and years. She was the director of GSA. Like she literally ran the organization. And so, I mean, if anybody can demystify how you get money and, you know, money moves around, it was her. So it was serendipitous, the fact that it was a friend of a friend of a friend. And they were like, oh yeah, you know, talk to Emily Murphy. So yeah, that was great. The, the article that you sent me the other day was, it was talking about how, General Brown, was saying that we kind of need to kind of pick some winners or just more handholding, I would say, in getting innovation companies that are doing things that we want and helping them get to the finish line. Cause I would assume you agree and correct me if I'm wrong, that there is zero handholding when you're a new company, even though you're meeting your contracts and you're doing all that, there's not a ton of government direct help getting you in the right rooms and conversations and getting you money. Would you agree?
I couldn't agree more. I outright agree. There's not enough, and it's almost, it's kind of like you don't want to point a finger. Like, I don't want to blame anyone for that. That's not necessarily any one person's fault. It's more missed opportunity. I think that it is part of the reason why we're not, like, the DoD isn't the bleeding edge, the private sector is. And if you go to China, probably the reverse. And that's one of the reasons is, in my opinion, one of the guilty parties. There's not this matchmaking mechanism. And I want to, it kind of goes hand in hand with what we were just saying again a little bit ago about, like, any large organization is going to have overlap or it's going to have repeated efforts with these task force. I also don't want to blame the DoD for doing that or the USAF for doing that. That's part of that happens. And I think, in fact, that can be good because sometimes it's, again, luck of the draw with the actual staff. A task force I would like to see pop up and repeat, even if it's overlapping and duplicated efforts, is what we've talked about before, almost where you have like someone who's close to the problem, warfighter or recent warfighter, not a bureaucrat, someone who's really close to the problem, teamed up with maybe like the bleeding edge, like the person who can actually do it, like what's called a Stanford student, a recently graduated, you know, Stanford nerd or something like that, and then some sort of contracting body. And I think that is a necessary kind of Knights of the Round Table group to put together, because you can't just throw out, hey, we need this, and expect like good things to happen. You're going to get, you know, a couple of years late from the B team. Whereas if you have kind of like the proactivity of, hey, let's go, these guys already did it, you know, in Silicon Valley, this company already did that. And then you go snatch them up and you have somebody who's close to the problem on the DoD side saying, hey, we don't quite need it that way. This is kind of how we want the problem solved. I understand that AI can help with that. I don't understand AI, blah, blah, blah. I think that's kind of how to bring that together. And I don't see that. I do see that sometimes. Like, I see AFWERX trying to do that. I see some groups trying to do that. So I don't want to shit on anybody because I'm not the first person to say this, but I do think that that is something that needs to be doubled down on. I think that truly, like, and we can go on and on and on about this. I hear from all these conferences, kind of one thing that I keep hearing over and over is relatively out of the game people, people who really know their stuff, one stars, two stars, or, you know, senior executives at like Lockheed or wherever. Maybe I shouldn't name names, but senior executives at large prime contractors in the United States, saying, hey, we need to close this gap. We got to go scoop up the smart kids. We got to go to MIT. We got to go to Berkeley. We got to go to Stanford. We got to get the smart kids. I think that's a mistake. And I kind of talked to Paco about this real briefly, and he feels that it is moving in the right direction, that there is kind of this trend of pairing up the companies that actually support those smart kids and get juice for the squeeze, pairing those companies up with the big prime contractors instead of trying to cut out the middleman. I do not think you're going to get the juice for the squeeze if you hire those kids directly. First of all, they don't want to work for the government in a lot of cases. That's a sad kind of truth, but you know, you're not going to win by trying to recruit those kids. They don't want to be, you know, in the military a lot of times. They don't even know that's an option. Maybe some of them would be open to it, but they don't even realize that's like an option if they're a data scientist coming out of MIT. And they don't probably want to work for like CAE or, you know, wherever the hell, Raytheon. If they do get in the door there, I don't think they have the structure, I would call it like infrastructure internally at those large companies to get really, really forward-thinking innovation from those kids. And so I think that the proper pairing is, and the trend that I was talking with Paco about, I would like to see the DAF kind of urge, I don't want to put responsibility on them or try to invent new government regulation, but I would like to see the DAF urge large primes to reach out to Silicon Valley and try to partner with them for the stuff that's really difficult, for like specialized stuff like data science or machine learning. Because I do think it can be done. I think the kind of environment for it to get done is Silicon Valley. And I hate to sound like I'm just one of these startup people banging on the drum of Silicon Valley, like we're the only ones who can do it. It's not that, but I do think it's one thing that Silicon Valley has done very, very well. Is getting kind of building the environment for really, really innovative stuff, really, really smart kids. You know what I'm trying to say.
And I think there's, again, you had a lot of really good points in the fact that I think it makes sense that there's different incentive structures. You know, so you have a kid who graduates and is exceptionally good at doing these types of programming and machine learning or AI or anything, and they go to a large prime. That large prime's incentive structure is different than a startup, because a startup is like, hey, high risk, high reward, like let's swing for the fences and really make some big impacts and make some cool stuff. Where a large prime, like large primes don't swing for the fences. Like they get base hits. They, you know, they're looking for that like slugging average, if you will. Like we're just trying to make money over time. And that's not a bad thing. Like we need large primes and we need them to do a good job. But I think everybody has their lane. Just like you can have the best programmers and the best company trying to produce products with no end user input or any guidance, and they're going to do their very best. But they're probably not going to do an exceptionally good job because they don't have that insight. So it's the combination of things. It's using the subject matter experts in the military, the people who actually are the end users. And again, another thing Paco and I talked about, or actually, no, it wasn't Paco, it was Rex Wysak with Rex and on his episode from... I forgot what I called that one, but either way, Rex and Blake were on that one. Maybe I called it that, but they were talking about how an engineer envisions the way a pilot wants to or will do something isn't always wrong, but it's not always exactly the way a pilot wants it, just because like they're not a pilot, and I won't try to tell an engineer how to produce it. So I think that is why, like the different incentive structures and just the inherent differences in people's roles. And we need everybody. Like one of the things is, you know, active duty military members have all the smarts. They know what's going on. And then they can't really help. There's no, you know, because obviously there's conflict of interest and all those things where you can't be active duty and help companies make better products, even though that's exactly what you should. So, but there is a place where hiring ex-military, retired military to help, right? Like, I assume that there's a lot of use and benefit from having military or prior military people helping out.
Yeah, big time. And before I get into that, I do want to say you made me think of something. It's the task force again. It's like that's why you need, you know, you hear everybody, I think it's like a trend now to bring up that sandwich thing. Like if I tell you how to make a peanut butter sandwich and I don't tell you like exactly. Yeah. It's that. That's like another feather or another reason to do the task force, like a small task force going around saying, you know, finding really innovative stuff to solve tomorrow's problems for the DoD. You can't just have an engineer. You can't just have a pilot. You can't just have a contracting expert. You're going to get the messed up sandwich. You need multiple parties there in a small little group going around and assessing. And you probably need a bunch of them, and they need to be exceptionally smart. I don't know about exceptionally. They need to be like, this is going to be an effect of like, it's not scalable, I guess is what I'm saying. It's not really a scalable thing. That's okay. We kind of, in Silicon Valley, we get like addicted to scalability. Sometimes non-scalable, I can't remember who I'm stealing this from, but maybe like a Basecamp. There's not, like sometimes non-scalable is the move. And I think that trying to find the bleeding edge and apply it to the military from a technical standpoint is not a scalable mechanism or activity. I think it is, in fact, very custom, very like ad hoc, very not scalable. I think you need a task force of like the right crew, Ocean's 11, kind of, you know, moving around freely, finding, in their opinion, the kind of best stuff to move the board, move the needle. To answer your question, bringing on, I think it goes hand in hand, bringing on either retired or collaborator who is active duty is as close as you can get to that from the private sector side. Like from our point of view, absolutely. Because we can only fill like the engineering seat, in my opinion, from like a Silicon Valley company standpoint. We need a hell of a lot of subject matter expertise from the military to kind of help us say like, oh, that's nifty. We don't give a shit about that, or this matters a ton more than you would think. Y'all don't care about it. We really care about it. So yeah, I think that's something that I do see that works very well is companies hiring, or let me put it this way, people at least get that they need to hire some subject matter experts. I think that's you know, pretty standard. Most of the time, it's probably not Silicon Valley companies doing that. It's people who are like dedicated to defense contracting. And in those situations, they're like founded by subject matter experts. So I would say a little bit yes, a little bit no. Let's evangelize that. Like, let's get Silicon Valley companies to realize, hey, you should probably throw, you know, a 2-star on your board, or you should probably hire someone who is recently separated. I don't want to get into all of the pilots leaving, but like, hire some folks, you know, go, they're out there. They're looking for jobs, you know, go hire some people, because you can build software very quickly. You don't know what the hell you're doing it for unless you can connect with the military.
And I this is not a spear. So I apologize if there are any generals listening. But one tough part is that, yeah, but the one tough part with hiring generals, which I think generals like 100% have a better big picture perspective, you know? So we talk about, you know, you break military thinking into kind of three categories, the tactical, I always forget, strategic and operation, or operational and strategic. So tactical, operational, strategic level thinking. So generals obviously have the strategic and operational thinking down. So big picture, how is the broader military going to use this? And I would never pretend to say I could replace a 2-star or 3-star's perspective. But the 2-star and 3-star haven't, for the most part, there's probably a couple out there who are wildly tactical still, don't have a ton of on the ground, you know, the kind of the guys who are currently pushing the buttons perspective. So tactics change, capabilities change. So that's one of the things that I think is, it's a weird kind of push-pull in, like, you need that, all of the perspectives. You need the tactical, you need the operational, you need the strategic perspective, because this is not living, you know, just like you said, yes, it will scale someday if it's successful and it works, but today it just needs to work, you know, and don't let like the scalability be the enemy of just making a product that does what needs to be solved. I agree with you.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I did kind of lump in like two-star or pilots under the same breath, and that's not fair. It's not, no one person can know it all. I mean, we go back to the Emily Murphy thing. It's crazy how big defense is, defense contracting is, you know, even all of, like, even the communication between defense is like another career. It's almost easy to kind of map it over to academics. Like, everyone kind of has a PhD in their own little thing, and there's not one person who's like, I'm just good at academia. Like, there's no one person can do all that. So you kind of do want both. If I was doing my own, you know, Silicon Valley, and we were going to company startup, and I was going to say, hey, we're going to be 80% defense or something like that, you don't just want a two-star. And I think that's probably a failure from a lot of companies. I don't want to speculate and say that's like a massive problem plaguing the industry right now, because I don't have enough data on it. But I would bet if you hooked yourself like a fancy two-star, you'd be like, we're done. Sweet. We get it. We got military. Big checkbox for like, do we have subject matter expertise here? And that's not fair. That's kind of putting too much pressure on that dude or lady, because they do have a certain subject matter. It's a subject. And you also need people who are really, really close to the problem today. Again, don't want to throw any spears. It's a hell of an accomplishment. I've never done anything close to that level of commitment and focus to get up to the general level. And I probably never will in my life do anything that's substantial. So I'm not trying to be disrespectful.
Yeah, same here.
But that you are far from the cockpit, so to speak. Like, you're not the right guy to ask for today's, you know, problem set, or you at least don't have the same perspective. You might know more about like how products actually get acquired. You know, you might know more about like, there's a trend there. I saw this happen again in the 90s and it's going to fizzle out, shit like that. That's, you know, the warfighter's not going to know that, you know?
Well, and I think, yeah, like you said, there's the difference in their perspective. Like, they may still fly, you know, generals, 1, 2, 3, 4 stars may still fly in airplanes. And they may, you know, they may have a lot of just experience over the years that keep them relatively current, because they are in briefings or making decisions on like what tech we're buying and, you know, what capabilities we're going to have, but that application of them. I mean, so I did suppression of enemy air defense, so SEED in the F-16, and I did it my whole career. I mean, I went to Misawa, which is a SEED base, then I went to McIntyre, which is another SEED base, and then I went to Holloman, which is the FTU, so where we teach the new students. And I had, I think it was like an 8-month gap between leaving my last base, which was a SEED base, and then I didn't do SEED for about 8 months. And then they were like, all right, you're back doing SEED because there's a SEED top-off course. And stuff had changed. In 8 months, stuff had changed. And I was like, whoa, that was fast. Like, I am out of date less than a year later. So now you think people who haven't been, like in the tactical side in years, you know. So there's something about that we just have, it's, we just have to acknowledge it and understand it's a reality. One story that, like,
go ahead. I was just gonna say, I was in here sweating because I feel like I threw a spear at generals.
No,
my bad. I didn't mean it.
I mean, the cool thing that I've
betrayed us.
Well, and the funny thing is that, like any generals, actually listen to my podcast. But either way,
that's right.
But the thing that I found, like young me, when I was a lieutenant and a captain, I mean, like in 05, like a lieutenant colonel above, I was like, I need to be anywhere other than in the same room with them. And just because I was like, I don't know, like, I don't want to you know, get myself in trouble. But the reality is, like, as I've grown up and interacted with, O5s, O6s, kernels, even some generals and limited experiences, they're the same dudes. They're just, you know, especially like the fighter pilot ones I've met, they're still bros. They're just bros that are way more successful than me, you know? So it's, we still have a lot of the similar conversations I have with my friends. So if I were to go back and, or talk to maybe some young, you know, people looking to be fighter pilots, I would say like, take those opportunities. Cause those one stars randomly, those two stars, you get a chance to talk to them, like pick their brain, you know, even if it's a dumb question, to him, maybe you gain something out of it. One story that I thought of when we were talking about engineers and pilots, I went to AFRL, so Air Force Research Lab. They have them all over the country. I went to one. I won't get into too many of the details, but they wanted some pilots to fly a simulator to test out some future capability. And so they were like, okay, you know, we have a tactic. We're trying to change that tactic with this new technology, which is how these things go. And so the engineers imagined one way we would fly. And that was like a very deliberate, like not slow airspeed, but like we are effectively going to like rejoin with the threat and then like kill the threat and then move on. And then they see us and me and one of my buddies, Drago, which his episode dropped relatively recently. We get in there and we are ripping around. I mean, we're like 450 knots, just like zooming across. Like we're, you know, we're like high aspect, like right over the top of these things and just like laying waste. And they're like, we had no idea that's how you would fly. And we're like, oh yeah. Like we're gonna, cause it's like, cause you do what you got to do, you know, like I'm just going to do this because this makes the most sense right now. Where the engineers, when they were doing their testing, just to make sure all their modeling was correct, were just like, it was very much a stable, like, almost like operating in a vacuum. And then we were like, hey, this exactly. Isn't working. And they were like, we didn't expect you would do that with it. And we were like, well, you know, we will. So there's a lot of that you kind of can't understand unless you just, you know, get the dude's perspective, which I appreciated that they reached out and were like, hey, come up and show us what you would want and what you would
totally.
Do so they can better understand the problem set.
That's the right way to say it is perspective. That's the word I was looking for this whole time. It's not that a two star is like been out of the cockpit too long necessarily. It's not that a, you know, current pilot doesn't understand acquisitions or doesn't understand trends in the military. And it's not that an engineer can't Google. It's that like, it's the perspective, it's the lenses that you're seeing the same exact thing through that, like put those people at the same table, a couple of them, you know, one from each party or whatever, a fellowship of the rings, if you will. And then that, yeah, you're going to get to Mordor. Cause I'm telling you, like it's the different perspectives are useful and they aren't, you can't be a dwarf. You can't be Gimli and Legolas. You just can't, you can't be both. You gotta pick a side. Yeah. You gotta pick a side.
I want to know who's who in this analogy, but
no. Dude, we can go so far down. I'm just gonna turn this into a Lord of the Rings podcast. You said something that reminded me of something that I wanted to bring up with you today. I was listening to one the other day and Bender said something that kind of, I had to like rewind to make sure I heard it right. And I wanted y'all to elaborate for me. He was saying that going from like, I think he was saying the F-35X, is that right? The F-35TX.
And he was saying like transitioning.
And he was saying the tactics are changing faster than anything in the jet. And that they change quite a lot. And that threw me for a loop. Is that large scale tactics, like how to engage in general, or it's like, that was surprising to me that tactics are changing all the time. Can you elaborate on that? I find that very interesting.
Yeah. So it gets exacerbated in new platforms. So you have a new platform and they're really still figuring it out, like how things work. So the 35, when it first came out, I think this was on the Merck episode. So Greg Merck Frana, really cool dude. He was the initial cadre in the 35. So he experienced, I mean, like ground level F-35 where like, you know, every week they're figuring out new stuff or new tech is being kind of unlocked because these jets are like getting like fully developed because test pilots are literally still doing like developmental tests on them. So, but I would say every platform, every jet is experiencing this because what ends up happening is say you're flying an F-16, which is not new by any stretch of the imagination. But what ends up happening is you still get software updates to your jet. So stuff will change like, hey, now we have a better capability of doing whatever. And then now your tactic can change because now you can do the thing that you previously could not. And so the F-35 is just doing that. And at a period of time, it was like weeks and then it was months and, you know, 6 months. And then there's going to be a time just like the F-16 where it's like every year, your jet is going to kind of level up effectively and you're going to get a better capability to hand adversary jamming. You know, your radar wants to see the bad guy. The bad guy's jammer doesn't want you to see him and it's going to be this fight. And so we have this, it's like heat seeking missiles is a really great way to explain it. The first heat seeking missiles had no countermeasure detection or deterrent or anything because it was like, I just see a heat source and I go after it. And, you know, bad on you if the sun happens to be in the background, because it turns out that thing's going to go after the sun. So, but then the enemy was like, wait, all I have to do is put out something else hot. And then your missile is going to go after the other hot thing maybe. And then they were like, okay, the bad guys are now dropping flares, which is literally just like something that is maybe the same heat, maybe slightly hotter, depends. Then your engine to decoy off that missile. So now they're like, okay, now we have to have some logic in the missile to then say, hey, I see two heat sources, and then the missile needs to figure out which one's which and go after the right one. And this has happened, I mean, since like the 70s, where it's like we have infrared countermeasures, then the missile has infrared countermeasures, and then the enemy comes up with another, you know. And so that's why the tactic is always changing, because the enemy is always gets a vote, we say. They get a vote in what we can or what we have to deal with, and then our tactic will change, and then we get even new software. It's the same missile, but new software in the missile, and now the missile can handle like infrared countermeasures better. And
okay, so that helps. Like that makes more sense to me than like you're redrawing. It's not that you're like coming up with like, oh no, knight to, you know, D4 is actually the smarter move here. It's that like it's an effect, it's a direct effect of the software or the tech. Like, okay, now given that our heat seekers are also effective in these situations because they have countermeasures or whatever, that changes how we would play in this setup.
Well, exactly. And there's some things that are like little changes that it's like, hey, remember when you wouldn't shoot your missile in this case? Now you can. And you're like, oh, cool. And then sometimes they're like, hey, remember when you thought you were alive at this range from this bad missile? You're dead, actually. So, you know, and the whole, like, exactly. So like, oh, we didn't carry the one or whatever. So, you know, now you have to leave X number of miles farther or, you know, so like some of it is like an entire tactical change. Like everything you now do relative to this threat is changed, or like, hey, you just have a little bit better game in something. So there's a lot of that, but you never stop learning. Like if anybody thinks, hey, I'm going to go be a fighter pilot specifically, and I'm going to like learn it, and then I'm going to be done learning. And a lot of careers are this way. You're always learning. You're always learning new stuff. Probably at least once a month, there should be weapons academics. So the weapons officer, who's the tactical leader, is going to say, hey, these are the new things that are coming out. Our books that tell us what to do are always being rewritten. It's like they drop the book and almost immediately start writing the next version of the book because stuff changes that fast, and it's only going to change faster in the future, because in the past it was all hardware. It was like, if we want to make a change to a jet, it has to be a hardware change. But now, which is the correct thing to do, like making things more modular and making stuff where I can change the software and get a different output from the same hardware, I mean, that's some quick changes. And that's really the exciting thing. And that's where tactics generation is going to explode.
Yeah. I can't get away from like even more is making me think like the Fellowship of the Ring setup is the right way, because you need, with that many moving parts, you need just as many like perspectives seeing the same thing through different lenses and saying, hey, wait a second, this actually applies to radar. We had no idea this would apply to radar, but now we can engage from, you know, wherever the hell, 2 miles out or whatever, instead of 1.5. So yeah, I think I'm really beating the drum. That's kind of my big thing recently, is it's not like the old, it's just like you said with seed changing every 8 months, what worked for contracting on both sides of the table, what worked for the Pentagon and the industry in 2005, not anymore. That's not the setup anymore. And it's not just that like, oh, so big bad Silicon Valley came in and now they're doing it. That's not it. It's just that like shit changes. You need to invite more people to the fellowship. You got to have kind of a representative from each camp. And I think that, again, not scalable, but that's going to have the biggest impact for the warfighter. That's going to keep us up, you know, up front, ahead, leading edge. If you have members of kind of every little camp that's relevant going around, and maybe it's hunting for product. Maybe it is picking winners. I find myself saying picking winners a lot recently. Maybe it is. Maybe it's just that. But maybe it's more broad, or you don't even want to limit it. Maybe it's just kind of figuring out what the application for bleeding edge technology in the commercial market is for. How does it map over? What's the effect? Why does this matter for the military? Does it matter for the military? So when something like, you know, VR mass produced, like pretty decent, you know, the Oculus or something, pretty decent VR comes out in the commercial space, you have, instead of just, you know, a couple of people at DARPA or whatever saying like, oh yeah, we've kind of explored this, you have a, you know, cutting edge group of people saying, here's the best activity for this, or the best application for this in the military, let's run with that, you know, kind of double down on this, and then the Pentagon throws money at it.
Well, I think so, kind of expanding on what is probably going to happen. Again, I can't see the future, but I'm going to make some assumptions here. So we'll take like data-driven readiness. So like Crowdbotics' debrief capability that they're creating. So now we're taking a fighter pilot who will go fight another fighter pilot or a group of fighter pilots, and they'll come back, and then they will use AI to help analyze that fight. So now we're gonna not only gain the benefit of having the computers help us focus our efforts, so we're going to now have a more timely debrief and a more focused debrief to hopefully like glean the most information we can in the best amount of time. But then beyond that, now we're going to have the ability to now leverage that technology and that capability to do the next thing. So I expect as we get more and more stuff like automated scheduling and AI analytics and debriefs and all these things, it's going to allow us to then spend our time on different things. And it may be tactics generation. It may be understanding that the thing we thought we were doing correctly or incorrectly is not true, because now we have a computer who's like, no, 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 no. Like the reality is this. And I think that's what we're going to find. And we've talked about this a lot in the past, is I think there are so many things in the data that we already capture that is missed because we just don't have something that is objectively better than a human watching screens and three D positional data from TISP data. Like we don't leverage computers to help us with that. And I think that is going to be a big game changer.
Yeah, and this kind of goes back to the stovepipe nature of at least the USAF. I assume it's the rest of the DoD as well. Some groups are kind of already doing it and playing around with it and have been for a few years. And some groups are like, we take a Polaroid of the jet and that's what we use for debrief. Some groups are like, it's a huge amount of variability. So, I think, you know, good tie-in, or I can plug our company or whatever. This is like one of those things I would say the task force would have recognized an ideal, you know, Fellowship of the Rings. 10 years ago or whatever would have said, okay, hey, hang on a second. We are putting a significant amount of the burden on eyeballs and subjectivity where, holy crap, like software's caught up to this. Like it can just say every, you know, fraction of a second, here's exactly where the jet was, here's how fast it was moving, here's its energy, here's its, you know, angle, et cetera, all of that. Why not let computers do what computers are good at on the time-saving side alone? Just because IPs, you and I know this, you know it much better than I do, IPs have an exorbitant amount of pressure on them and they stay late. They, if they don't stay late, the job doesn't get done right. They kind of have a huge, it's a bit lopsided in my opinion. A huge amount of the burden is on IPs, instructor pilots, and stuff like this, just saving time helps them. If they're clearer headed, they can be a better teacher or instructor. And then you get into like the other effects of looking at the data. You kind of touched on it, writing tactics, looking at the efficacy of weapons, new weapons, looking at stuff like, we don't know what the latest and greatest, you know, NGAD system is or what its capabilities are. Plug it in, see what happens when, you know, in any given scenario. Analyzing stuff that where you would have way too many people on the ground trying to, you know, kind of follow along, by the way, in different distinct debrief tools for large scale exercises like red flag or orange flag. That's a big hassle to analyze the exact kind of every second what went down. Why not go nuts with software in fields like that? That's kind of what we're trying to do. So Vader's been mentioning DDR. It's data-driven readiness is this product we built. And it does have some debrief capability. I would like to see it rolled out as just a debrief tool. I think that would be a step in the right direction. We use AI and ML to kind of assess what happened during the sortie. And then we score exactly like, you know, if you attempted a maneuver, we score it based on the textbook kind of parameters. It can also be used just to assess, you know, weapons, you know, BFM, any of this kind of stuff. And so I would file all that under like maneuvers that we can score. And so we're interested in running with that and seeing what, you know, value that brings. Might just be data management, moving data around, sharing data. That's kind of a big initiative. And, you know, wherever it's like the most valuable, but that's what we kind of keep touching on for the listener. Some context there.
And yeah, sorry. Yeah, sorry, everybody. No, I just assume you'd already done your research.
I need to do a plug.
One thing I think, viewing BFM, so we'll speak broad brush here. Like viewing BFM as the large motor skills of how we execute airplanes, in airplanes technically, it like having analytics help you with those large motor skills and then demonstrating proficiency with the analytics in that ability of like, hey, here's our windows for execution, for performance that you say you want to meet to be able to maintain an offensive position if you're an offensive dogfighting or BFM, basic fighter maneuvers. And then be able to prosecute, whether it's with your missiles or with your gun on your aircraft. We'll call those large motor skills. And we demonstrate proficiency. And just like we talked about scalability, it doesn't have to be baked in initially, but we want to demo pro that capability. Now we talk fine motor skills. These are massive multi-aircraft, 60, 70 aircraft in a red flag. And now we can run analytics on, hey, what did we want to achieve? And what did we actually do? And did we buy more deaths because we didn't meet our tactic? Or did we not lose anybody even though we deviated from our tactic? And then these are like those fine motor skills, especially when you start getting into fifth and sixth gen, where the rules for an F-16, like going to kill the bad guys, is different than for fifth and I assume sixth gen. So they are also going to need this capability to hopefully have computers help them confirm tactics or invalidate tactics that they're not currently realizing. So I think there's a lot of goodness that can come out of specifically just analytics, you know, the data analytics side of everything.
Totally. And there's so much, one thing that Air Force has done really well is data collection.
Like there is good data. It's very rich data. The even from the F-15, like in the training environment, there's a ton of data that's coming off the jet, not really being utilized or not being, you know, examined as thoroughly. There needs to be kind of a widespread updating of the way data is processed in the DoD. And that, like, I'm now speaking to pilots. If you're looking to kind of bridge over to the private sector, that's one example, one area that's not even necessarily bleeding edge. That's one area that, you know, we've been able to make an impact in just a couple of years. I think we're going to continue to make an impact and even kind of grow our footprint. This is the kind of stuff that, like, Silicon Valley is rocking and rolling on. We need the help of pilots or the warfighter or whomever is next to the problem for that specific thing. Same, it's data, so it's not just pilots. I don't want to limit it to that. But, like, we need y'all's help to come in and say, hey, here's the application for this. Like, we wouldn't have just been able to sit there and say, oh, I bet the USAF doesn't utilize the data coming off of the Strike Eagle. We could probably build a debrief tool for that. No, we had to, like, pair up with some fighter pilots who said, hey, is data science here yet? Can we, you know, is this possible? We said, yeah, we think so. Let's play around with it. There you go. And that's, you know, we come back to, you kind of got to pair up the right people with the right people to see not only what's possible and to build it, but to then apply it in the right place. And I'm doing all of this, by the way, just so that I can get to space. It's not that I love fighter pilots. I'm trying to get to Space Force as soon as possible. Yeah. I'm mad that I never got to fly in the Strike Eagle. As soon as we signed the contract, no one ever took me up. Next stop, I'm going to I'm trying to get to space, so.
There you go. They'll probably make good science on that.
Yeah, they'll make good on that. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, Strike Eagle guys are sandbagging. Well, not to derail the conversation, but mildly derail the conversation, two things. One, a update. So on the first episode that we talked, Top Gun Maverick had just come out, and we talked a lot about Top Gun Maverick. And I actually made a statement that I later saw, because obviously I watched it again. I later saw that I was incorrect. So remember when Maverick was going like Mach, I think it was like 8 or 9
10.
Or something.
I think he used
like,
10.
Well, yeah, but he's not quite there. He's like getting ready to do his last run. And he's like, hey, I'm just going to like flip a U. And I was like, that would take like 3 states. Well, sure enough, when they go back to the control center, I look and there's like the map of the U.S. and he literally like bangs a left in Utah and then ends up in like Montana going back the other way. And I was like, okay, nice. Yeah, I dig that. Like that.
All right. Yeah. Good so for them like, okay, for building it right. Yeah.
It's a turn radius, you know, it's not like it's high science. It's like, you know, degrees per second and stuff. So, so I had to correct that, you know, I'm not trying to put out any, BS info. So now
that's
I have
right.
a random question.
This isn't
for
a fake news podcast. This is
yeah, that's right.
This podcast takes truth very seriously. Here.
Yeah. Well, and I appreciate my buddy Tron. He like when these episodes air and I appreciate that he listens to him and he'll go, hey man, turns out like it's actually this. And I'm like, oh, I didn't know that. So he's way smarter than me. So it makes sense why.
You need a Jamie and you need like a fact checker to be like,
that's right. Yeah, guy, exactly. Like, no,
how is this guy talking
that.
About hiring 2-star generals? What the hell?
Yeah, just stop what you're saying. So one question I have for you, and this is going to make some people mad, hopefully not me. So, I mean, I was an F-16 guy. Now I fly the C model. But you've hung out with Strike Eagle pilots, F-16 pilots, F-22 pilots, you know, the gamut of fighter pilots. And I think it may be even A-10 pilots. So attack pilots. What's your favorite community?
A-10.
Oh, nice.
I hate to have an answer so quickly. Yeah, I am glad. I'm glad you're stroking my ego here. This is one thing we do pretty well for a small defense contractor is buddy up with pilots. We have a pretty good Rolodex at this point of people who know what they're talking about, depending on the aircraft. The community that's the coolest is a different question from what's the coolest aircraft. Coolest aircraft I got, it's the Warthog. I think it's the best. I like the A-10 the best. I think it's the coolest thing in the world. The coolest community of fighter pilots, you know, I can't say Strike Eagle because they're bomber pilots, you know?
It's not, yeah. I didn't really say that, everybody. It wasn't me.
Yeah, I would say the coolest community of bombers is Strike Eagle pilots. You know, the best bomber community is the Strike Eagle.
I haven't met any B-21 pilots yet, so who knows?
But. Yeah, no, yeah. I knew the B-21 was going to come up. I wanted to get your two cents on the B-21. I would say the coolest community is fighter pilots. Like, that's like a half-ass, lazy answer to not piss anyone off. The coolest community is just fighters. If you want to get in within that and say which one's the best, you know, to a layman like me, it's just hard. I can't even. All of you guys are so cool. It's hard to say who's cooler. It's like who's cooler.
It's all gravy then.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Shaq and Kobe, you know, what do I don't know who's cooler. Yeah.
Well, the thing I take away from that is it's going to make it all the more sweeter when they defund the A-10. So just get that thing out of here.
Yeah. That's kind of the thing. I mean, you know better than I, but it's kind of held on longer than it was supposed to anyway, right?
Yeah. And I'll say this, which I appreciate the A-10 because the A-10 is extremely good at what it does. And the fact that, you know, when the 35 is coming online, they're like, we don't need the A-10. We're going to have the F-35. And it's like, you're going to use a stealth fighter to replace an A-10. Like, that's the most ridiculous thing. Like, the A-10 is very, very good at doing air-to-ground and the Sandy mission, which if anybody doesn't know what the Sandy mission is, which I don't really know. I'm not a Sandy. Those are the people who help pick up people who end up on the ground. So if a pilot or multiple pilots or just people get stranded in enemy territory, Sandys are going to come in and lay waste to ensure that those people get picked up. And they've done that for decades and decades. So like, I respect that mission, and they are literally the best at it. And it would be difficult. Here's a nod to the Strike Eagle. I would say probably the only plane we currently have is probably the Strike Eagle, or maybe the EX, if you want to say we currently have that, that could replace the A-10 in the Sandy mission, solely because there's two people trying to make it work, where the A-10 is just mech'd to be good at that. When the A-10 does go away, sooner or later all jets go away, we will lose a capability. Sadly, the reason it's going to go away is it's not survivable, you know, and most of our jets are not survivable in our near peer type fights. And that's just a reality.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. Exactly. And I don't know what I'm talking about in this realm, but like nothing else does that, right? Nothing else is like exactly for just coming down low, taking out whatever's there, whether it's a tank or some other ground forces or whatever the hell. Doesn't really matter. The A-10 will attack it. And what else can really do that?
Yeah, I mean, the A-10, everybody probably knows this, the aircraft was built around the gun. So there's a joke where it's like, oh, my jet has a gun. And then A-10 people say, my gun has a jet. And because it's literally the whole plane was built to have, like, around, okay, here's the gun, build a plane. And so the gun is amazing. The gun is a 30 millimeter, is it a Gal 7 or something like that? Gal 6, doesn't matter. But either way, it's a massive gun. It shoots a 30 millimeter round. Tank killer, I don't know, turn a three-story building into Swiss cheese. Like, I think they have 11 hard points where they can carry a complement of 500-pound bombs and Mavericks. And they'll fly at 300 feet. And the best thing I would say that makes them as good as they are at what they do is they can fly. They don't fly exceptionally lower. Like, they fly lower. Like, in an F-16, I flew 300 feet. And a lot of A-10 guys fly 300 feet. But they can also have guys that fly 100 feet, which is lower. But the reality is they can get slow. And so in an F-16, I used to go 480 knots at 300 feet, which is its own problem set because you're going real fast. But the reality is when A-10s can get low and slow, it just slows the ground game down. So they can get they can just be slow, look out the window, say like, I see the bad guys, and then go after them. So they have a lot of loiter time because they don't have a super thirsty jet engine. They have these like more, we'll call them economical motors that aren't going to get them that fast, but they don't need to get fast. They get low and slow, and then they loiter a long time, and they have a lot of weapons, and they have one mission set. and they get real good at it. So, you know, I'll you know, bag on other platforms and stuff. But the reality is every platform, for the most part, has a lot of utility and benefit in what they bring to the fight. I mean, they wouldn't be there if they didn't have some aspect and goodness there. So, yeah, we just like to, you know, I mean, well, now that I'm in the C model course, everybody likes to take shots of the F-16. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you know. Used to fly it, but now I'm a C-model guy.
You're like, oh, yeah, what's up with those guys? My God. There's more F-16s, though, right? There's more. Isn't it the most populous, the most numerous jet in the force?
This is, people should definitely fact check this statement, but I think it's the most proliferated jet in the world. Like, I think out of all jets, the F-16 in the U.S., and just other countries, I think it is the like the biggest fleet of a single fighter. But that
rocks.
Yeah, so I mean,
think that rocks.
Yeah, and there's a lot of good stuff with the F-16. It has its capabilities, but it has its limitations. You know, so it's not gonna perfectly replace an A-10. It's not gonna replace a C model. You know, it has its role, and I think a good pilot in F-16 can do that role very well, especially in seed. And I would argue that seed is one of, especially F-16 seed, because seed kind of varies between aircraft, that seed is one of the most dynamic and fun mission sets you can do in any airplane. And I enjoyed doing it because it was wild. Like, it was so much fun. I'm surprised more people don't screw the pooch doing seed in the F-16, because there are tons of opportunities to get yourself in a bad spot, you know, run jets together. So I appreciate that that seed pilots are professionals and do their job well, because it is not easy for one person to do all those things.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, bam. I'm looking for the contract for what's the A-10 in space. That's the intersection I would like to contract 10. In.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Space 10. Yeah, if we can get that, I'm in. It's
yeah,
space. You lose the loudness, though, right? The like burr. You lose the intimidation factor of the sound of an A-10 coming and shooting at you, because there's no sound. In space, no one can hear you scream.
That's right. Well, but you always
it's less
sneak
intimidating.
Up on them. Yeah, they never hear you coming, so you're like, hey, there you go.
It's low orbit. It's slow and it's low orbit. Yeah.
That's right. The space vipers are at like, you know, like way up there.
And the F-15 just still, it looks the exact same, but it can fly in space.
Yeah, I was going to say that was a nice thing. Like, going from the F-16, which like a Block 50 F-16s and 52, I mean, really all F-16s can get up into the high 30s and the 40s, but you're not maneuverable at all. And so I was doing a flight where I was high in the C model, and it just flew. Like, turns out when you have massive wings, like, they work when the air is thin. So that was kind of fun, you know, like get up real high, like, you know, and get fast. And it was like, yeah, the jet turns, where the F-16 kind of like, it's like a leaf falling out of the sky. And you're like, well, you gotta be real ginger with the airplane up here, because it just runs out of energy real quick. Cause not a ton of air is passing over those wings, so you gotta just take it slow, you know.
Yeah.
Well, Julian, right. Any
final thoughts on the B-21 before we jump off? I wanted to get your like unadulterated perspective on the Raider after this newish announcement.
Yeah, I hesitate to say this, because if people don't realize, most people get nervous to talk about like classified platforms. Like, you look at them. And then I'm not supposed to speculate, so I'll try not to speculate here. Just like I said, and I guess it was actually a relatively good segue, every aircraft we have has its role and its benefit and its goodness. And just looking at pictures, no briefings or anything, it looks rather similar to a B-2. So now I wonder, like, what's its role? Like, what are we gaining? What tactical advantage, what benefit is there coming from having a B-2 and a B-21? And Paco, his podcast, or not his podcast, he also has a podcast, which people should check out, the Merge podcast, but also he has his newsletter, which is, and he said, I think it was last week or the week before, he called it the B2.1 instead of the B21.
That's right.
Yeah, and I think that is like, again, as just outside looking in, I don't have any briefings. I wonder what tactical advantage and what benefit we're gaining from a B21 that a B2 with upgraded guts doesn't give you. So that's my argument, you know, like it with like the F-15 EX is a perfect example. It's like, wait, we already have an F-15C and an F-15E. Is it just new technology inside and cheaper than buying 6th gen? Yes. Okay,
yeah.
Then I see the position we're in and why we're buying a new one. Maybe, you know, we have limitations that I'm unaware of that the B-21 is going to fill. So not maybe a little tiny spear at the B-21. But
no, I think that's polite. I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
That's informative and helpful for me. I hope so for the listener. My last, like, whatever the final thoughts or final last word or whatever is, yeah, I think my big thing that I'm, like, recently kind of chewing on and mulling over and annoying everybody, calling them in the middle of the night, talking to them about is like, you gotta have some sort of, AFWERX does a good job. I think there's other groups that try to do this, and there's individuals that I didn't shout out who deserve credit for trying to do this. But you gotta have some sort of Lord of the Rings setup where individual experts are gathering together and saying, hey, pair this here. This belongs here. And like the further you go, the more important it is, because like data science is not even that cutting edge. And it was really difficult for us to find a long-term home. We think maybe we have that now at Nellis, working on some interesting stuff out there with Test. And I think that that's a really good place for data. It took us a while. Like, there wasn't just like somebody who came out and was like, hey, here's where this belongs long-term. And that's tough. I think that's not one person's job. That's like a task force type of thing. So that's kind of my final thing that I would like to push, or at least get smarter people than me talking about. Because I think that's how you pair up all of the power of innovation in the United States, greatest country on earth, and the DoD. Yep.
Yeah, and I think exactly that. Having a task force, and there's that balance where the Air Force is so large and there's so many people, because you would want input from every aspect, but then you would have thousands of people on a task force, which would, you know, negate the task force's benefit. So having that balance of like a handful of people who have a very broad perspective, who can provide insight there. And I agree, because I think there should be, just like General Brown was saying, like do a little more handholding. Like, we need to get the people who are super smart and can create products that never in my lifetime could I create, that we need to get them in front of the right people who can allocate funds, who can sign contracts. Because if we don't, we're going to have exceptional people with exceptional products that we're going to do nothing with or very little with. And we're not going to gain the benefit of the entire premise of the program, which is make a ton of small bets and then let the best kind of rise to the top. So I couldn't agree more, Julian. But well, I'll let you get going, cause we've been running for a bit. Thank you again for coming on the podcast and chatting. Yeah.
Well, this is always a pleasure. Always a pleasure to talk. Sorry if this is, I think other episodes are probably more informative. But hopefully this is at least a little bit informative to see a Silicon Valley perspective, sorta, for anyone listening. So hopefully this is valuable. Thank you for having me on. It's always, always, always a pleasure.
Yeah. Thank you. Do you want to give everybody your email and stuff? They probably heard it on previous podcasts, but you can always send it out again.
My name's Julian, Julian, and the company's called crowdbotics.com, just crowdbotics, like robotics, crowdbotics.com. So Julian@crowdbotics.com is my email. I'd love to talk to any pilots ever. That's kind of our cup of tea, neck of the woods, is fighter pilots in USAF. But I think there's a lot that Silicon Valley can do for the DoD, and I'm always just interested to talk shoot the shit, hear from y'all, hear perspectives. And then if you've got ideas and you want to mull it over and chat, I'm always interested in that kind of stuff too. So thanks, Vader, for having this. Big shout out to Paco and the Merge podcast as well. But thanks for doing this. I think this is like enormously helpful to guys like me.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it. And I appreciate your perspective. Cause again, I can't glean your perspective without getting your input. So thank you for that. Everybody, if you want to reach out to the podcast and give us your feedback on what we're doing well or doing poorly, info@KodiakShack.com is going to be the email that you'll email, and then our website, KodiakShack.com. So let us know what you think of the podcast, or if you you want us to talk to people that we're not talking to. But thanks again, Julian. See ya.
See ya.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.